President Joe Biden addresses the UN.
My fellow leaders, I truly believe we're at another inflection point in world history. But the choices we make today will determine our future for decades to come.
Plus, almost 500 dead in Israeli strikes in Lebanon as hostilities rise.
A Lebanese official said it was the country's deadliest day in decades. Israel's military said it struck Hezbollah targets in Lebanon's south, east, and north, including, quote, launchers, command posts, and terrorist infrastructure.
And later, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continues his diplomatic efforts in the U.S. Today is Tuesday, September 24th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden addressed the UN General Assembly on Tuesday. He warned against a full-scale war in Lebanon and says it's time to end the conflict in Gaza.
My fellow leaders, I truly believe we're at another inflection point in world history. But the choices we make today will determine our future for decades to come. Will we stand behind the principles that unite us? We stand firm against aggression. Will we end the conflicts that are raging today? We take on global challenges like climate change, hunger, and disease. Will we plan now for the opportunities and risk of a revolutionary new technologies? I want to talk today about each of these decisions and the actions, in my view, we must take.
For more, I'm joined by VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
He tried to be an optimist, I think, in his farewell speech to the international community. He talked about how when he first got into politics in 1972, that the U.S. was involved in the Vietnam War. It was raging at the time. But then he pointed to the fact that today U.S., the United States, and Vietnam are partners and they're friends. And he said things can get better and we shouldn't forget that. And I think that was a really important thing to say at this time, because as the Secretary General of the United Nations pointed out in his remarks, the world is facing so many conflicts and crises all at once. And he, Antonio Guterres, said the world cannot go on like this. So I feel like Biden's reminder was a good thing.
So how much of his speech was the elder statesman on his way out looking back with rose-colored glasses, and how much of it was new information, new proposals, and new ideas for going forward?
Yeah, interesting. I think it was a little bit like a review of his 4 years in office, the things his administration has accomplished, also his return to the multilateral stage after President Trump withdrew the United States from, for instance, the Paris Climate Accord, the World Health Organization. They cut funding to several UN agencies. Joe Biden reversed a lot of those measures. As he pointed out, he did some of them on day one of his administration, like rejoining the climate agreement. So he was kind of reminding other countries that the U.S. has been involved in many multilateral efforts here. There was that, but then he was also talking about the current conflicts that are facing the world.
And what is he saying about those conflicts? What is he saying should be done in the future?
Well, on Ukraine, he was very clear that the world needs to stand by Ukraine, that you can't grow weary and look away or let up on your support of Ukraine, not until they have a just and durable peace that's based on the principles of the UN Charter. He spoke about Lebanon, which has in the last week or so, the escalation between Lebanon's Hezbollah militants and Israel has really escalated to the brink of disaster. He said, we're working to de-escalate that. And he spoke about the Gaza ceasefire that the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have been working on for literally months now. He said, now is the time for parties to finalize it, to bring home the hostages, to free Gaza from its humanitarian crisis and the grip of Hamas, and to end the war. And he got a lot of applause for that as well, for that line.
Margaret, you've got a view to the UN that few people have. You get to see behind the scenes, backstage, in the halls of power, so to speak. We just get to watch it on the TV screens. What's the mood in the building when Joe Biden is talking? Are people hopeful? Are they scared? How was his speech received?
Well, I think it's a very tense UN General Assembly this year. It's very tense because of the escalation between Lebanon and between Lebanon's Hezbollah and Israel this week. Yesterday was a deadly day, and you know, we all thought going into this week that the focus is going to be on Gaza, but it's really shifted now to trying to de-escalate Lebanon because it could turn into a regional war. Let's face facts, it's on the way. So there's a lot of anxiety among leaders here. The Lebanese caretaker prime minister, for instance, wasn't going to come to the UN General Assembly this year because of problems at home, but today it was announced he will be coming. You know, he's coming in a hurry because things are really bad and he needs to rally international support for his country. You know, so it's sort of a big scramble now. And I think people wanted to hear what Joe Biden had to say, if there was anything new he had to say. But really, it was just kind of a swan song speech. I didn't hear anything particularly new in it or groundbreaking. I thought it was interesting, though, at the end of it, he did refer to the decision he made over the summer about dropping out of the race for a second term. And he said it was a very difficult decision for him to make. It was a very personal thing for him to say in front of the whole world. And he said, as much as he loves his job, he loves his country more. And it was time for a new generation of leadership to take the United States forward. And it was also kind of a message to some of the leaders in the audience who have clung to power in many countries for many years. And he said, some things are more important than staying in power. It's your people. And he got a lot of applause for that. And he said, we're here to serve the people, not the other way around.
It's VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. Margaret, thanks so much for taking the time out of what is no doubt a very busy day to chat with us.
Thanks, Steve.
High on the agenda at the UNGA and a top story all over the world is the escalation in tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel's military said it launched more airstrikes against Hezbollah sites in Lebanon on Monday. Lebanese authorities say those strikes have killed 492 people and have sent tens of thousands fleeing for safety. Reuters' Gabe Singer has the story.
Israel's military said it struck over 1,000 Hezbollah targets in Lebanon on Monday. And Lebanese authorities said those same strikes killed 492 people, including 35 children. A Lebanese official said it was the country's deadliest day in decades. Israel's military said it struck Hezbollah targets in Lebanon's south, east, and north, including, quote, launchers, command posts, and terrorist infrastructure. It released this video of what it said were airstrikes on Hezbollah weapons caches. On Monday evening, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the Lebanese people in a short video.
I have a message for the people of Lebanon. Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons. Now, starting this morning, the IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously.
Reuters could not independently verify Netanyahu's assertion that Hezbollah has hidden weapons in houses, but Hezbollah has said it does not place military infrastructure near civilians. Traffic slowed to a crawl on Monday along roads leading out of the city of Sidon as families from South Lebanon fled the bombing.
Strikes, warplanes, destruction. No one is left here. Everyone has fled. We took our belongings and left.
Reuters spoke to several families that were headed north to Beirut. They did not know where they would stay or when it would be safe to return. On Monday evening, Israel launched a strike on Beirut's southern suburbs aimed at Hezbollah leader Ali Karaki, the head of the group's southern front. Hezbollah later said he was safe and had moved to a secure location. However, the armed wing of Hamas said its field commander in southern Lebanon was killed in an Israeli airstrike. In response to Monday's airstrikes, Hezbollah said it had launched dozens of missiles at a military base in northern Israel. Israel's military said sirens warning of Hezbollah rocket fire sounded across the region, including in the port city of Haifa. This video taken by bystanders show what appeared to be interceptions of Hezbollah rockets there. Monday marks the heaviest cross-border exchanges of fire between Israel and Hezbollah since hostilities flared in October last year. The fighting has raised fears that the U.S., Israel's close ally, and Iran will be dragged into a wider war. A senior U.S. official said the United States does not support a cross-border escalation between Israel and Hezbollah. They added that Washington was going to discuss, quote, concrete ideas with allies and partners to prevent the war from broadening.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us today. In a related story, the U.S. is sending a small number of additional troops to the Middle East in response to the sharp spike in violence between Israel and Hezbollah forces in Lebanon. Major General Pat Ryder, the Pentagon press secretary, would not say how many more forces would be deployed or what specifically they would be tasked to do. The U.S. currently has about 40,000 troops in the region. You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the UN Summit of the Future on Monday. We'll discuss it with a former ambassador to Kyiv. Up first, though, is the latest news on President Zelensky's diplomatic efforts during his travels to the U.S. Our correspondent in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova, has the details.
The President of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, spoke on Monday at the UN Future Summit and called for global unity to overcome what he calls the destructive power of Russia and its allies. Zelensky noted that Ukraine is preparing for the second peace summit, which Ukraine aims to hold by the end of 2024, and the venue is still to be determined. At the summit, Ukraine plans to address the issues of food and energy security, holding Russia accountable, the release of prisoners of war, and the restoration of the territorial integrity of Ukraine.
The world needs a peaceful future and sustainable development. And I say this as the president of Ukraine, a country resisting Russia's brutal colonial aggression. And we know exactly how much global unity can achieve both here at the UN and through the peace summits for Ukraine, where we aim to overcome the destructiveness of Russia and its accomplices.
On the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, Zelensky met with a bipartisan delegation of the US Congress and presented them with his so-called victory plan, which reportedly includes the points of Ukraine receiving security guarantees from Western countries and an invitation to join NATO, request for more modern weapons, and international financial aid to support Ukrainian economy. Zelensky spoke in detail about the situation at the front line, the course of Ukrainian operations in the Kursk region of Russia, and the strengthening of the Ukrainian energy system.
Energy is not only about today, it's about tomorrow, but we have to prepare for heating season. Relates our weakness for today, because energy network is under attack each day.
As Ukraine is facing winter, energy security is one of the most important topics of discussion with international partners. Ukrainian experts predict from 4 to almost 20 hours of possible power outages per day during winter time if Russia continues to attack Ukrainian energy facilities. Zelensky also discussed the energy sector when he met with Fumio Kishida, the Prime Minister of Japan. After the meeting, he announced a new energy aid package from Japan. Zelensky also met with the heads of leading American energy, financial, and insurance companies, the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, and the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Management and Resources, Richard Verma, to discuss the preparation of the Ukrainian energy system for winter. Zelensky noted that plans and opportunities for implementing joint projects in the energy sector were discussed in detail.
Biggest challenge, what to do when you don't have electricity. So one thing, it's during the summer. Another thing, it's closer to the winter. So it's heating. It's not only electricity, it's connection, it's phone,
everything. That is your life.
Meanwhile, Russian troops launched another massive missile and drone attack on Ukraine. As a result of the attack, 20 settlements were left without electricity in the Poltava region. Debris damaged energy infrastructure and several private houses. However, no victims were reported. In Zaporizhia, to the south, one person was killed and at least 6 people were injured, including 2 children, as a result of the attack. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
As Anna mentioned, on Monday, President Zelensky addressed the UN's Summit of the Future. He'll address the entire UNGA on Wednesday. For a look at what was said and what it means, I'm joined by John Herbst. He's Senior Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine.
Look, he's in a very difficult spot. Russian movement in the East continues. The administration is not allowing him to use ATACMS, or for that matter, British Storm Shadows, against legitimate Russian targets in Russia. And he's here to make his case. So he has, he talks about this secret peace plan, which of course necessarily starts with Ukraine getting the arms and the permission to use those arms that are needed. And he can point to the success they've had with the Kursk offensive and with their own increasingly sophisticated and effective drone force attacking Russian ammunition dumps. But he still needs permission from the Biden administration to use those weapons on Russian targets. And of course, he's concerned about our upcoming elections. So he laid out, I think, a sensible series of steps designed in their own, not always direct way, to get what he needs.
It sounds to me like you agree with him that if he had permission to use Western weapons inside Russian territory, the war would go better for him. What about the Russian statements that would be an escalation and further grow the war?
Look, when Russia escalates, they are doing what they consider necessary to win this war full of war crimes. When Ukraine would like to do something more, I'm not going to say provocative, but bolder, they say it's an escalation. This is a putz's game designed to intimidate Western leaders. And sadly, it's worked with the Biden administration and with Scholz in Germany. How many times have the Russians threatened dire consequences if Ukraine did X with Western support and nothing happened? The Biden team should have learned this by now, but sadly, they have not.
And looking forward, do you see a change with either a Harris or a Trump administration?
I mean, the short answer is we don't know. Phil Gordon is cut from the same cloth as the current advisors to Biden. And of course, Gordon served in the Obama administration. He's been serving in the Biden administration, you know, on the Harris team. Harris does not have much foreign policy experience. She has wrapped herself around the Biden policy on Ukraine as a way to contrast her position with Donald Trump's. I think there's some political value for her in that. But what she actually means and what she actually would do, we can't say. I suspect it would be somewhat like Biden's policy. The key question is it going to have the same timidity, the same ability to be in the same subject to Putin intimidation that's characterized the Biden team? I hope not, but I don't know. And as for Trump, if J.D. Vance represents Trump policy, we will see a major American foreign policy debacle looming of us appeasing the Kremlin at Ukraine's expense, which would make Trump's foreign policy look far worse than the Biden policy did when we withdrew disastrously from Afghanistan. But if Trump policy is represented by the Pompeo op-ed in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago, it would be stronger than Biden's policy and better for the United States and, of course, for Ukraine.
Later in the week, President Zelensky will meet with Donald Trump, separately with Kamala Harris, as well as Joe Biden, to discuss his plan for peace. What do we know about that plan, and how can we expect American officials to react to it?
I don't know much about it. I mean, I've read everything that appears in the paper, but it's deliberately vague. I suggest it's more a collection of specific ideas and points as opposed to a whole coherent plan. And I think its key elements are that if there's going to be a just peace, Ukraine needs to be able to push the Russians further back on the battlefield. Putin needs to understand, because of Ukrainian success on the battlefield, that he can't win this war. So therefore, he's willing to consider just peace terms. And Zelensky will talk about some of the things he'd like to see in a peace, which will all be reasonable because he's the victim and Putin's the aggressor.
John Herbst is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He's currently a senior director for the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. Ambassador Herbst, thanks very much for your analysis today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And finally, today, under the Taliban, the news media in Afghanistan are among the least free in the world. But a new generation of journalists is still keen to learn the skills of the trade. Even women who are barred from attending university in Afghanistan are finding ways to study. VOA's Afghan Service has the story, narrated for us by Behzad Hamdard.
In this classroom in Kabul, Afghanistan, a new generation of journalists is learning about media. But students at the Waisal Education Center are starting their careers at a difficult time for the industry. They say restrictions by the country's Taliban government make it difficult for them to pursue their passion, a career in journalism. They also want experience working at the country's remaining newsrooms. Kaftan Utmanzai is a journalism student.
There are restrictions on media. We want these restrictions to be removed. Second, we request media organizations to provide us with the opportunity to work to become familiar with working in studios.
Othmanzai and his fellow students are starting out in journalism under dire conditions. Since the Taliban's return to power in 2021, media have worked under increasing censorship and economic hardships. Once a vibrant media scene, Afghanistan is now the third worst country for press freedom, ranking below North Korea and Iran, according to media watchdog Reporters Without Borders. Still, teachers at Waisal Education Center say that their students are still passionate about journalism. Wasim Waisal teaches at the Waisal Education Center.
They hope they will be able to work one day in the media. The restrictions and problems will not be there forever.
The Waisal Center may have students, but none are women. The Taliban banned women from education after primary school level, and dozens of female journalists can no longer work in media. Those who do must appear fully covered on screen. Rahima Naimi is a former lecturer of journalism at Rana University in Kabul. She says journalism was a popular field of study before the Taliban's return.
There were many women in higher education, particularly in journalism. There were many students dreaming of graduating and taking part in the field.
Women in Afghanistan still take online classes in journalism that Naimi and some organizations offer from outside Afghanistan's borders. But even with the training, fewer jobs remain. Dozens of media outlets have shuttered since the takeover. Hojatullah Mujadidi works with the Afghan Independent Journalists Association.
Unfortunately, media outlets can't create jobs anymore because of economic problems. Their personnel have decreased. The solution is that the international community should help the media financially so they can employ these educated and passionate youth.
While the country's media grapples with a tough environment, the next generation of journalists is learning the skills they need in the hope that restrictions will ease. For VOA Afghan Service, Behzad Hamdard, VOA News.
And that's going to end today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.